Welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Harmon, and next to me on this wet and windy day at the Oval is Phil Walker, Wisden Cricket Monthly's Editor-in-Chief. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Joe.
And Wisden.com's Taha Hashim. Hello, Taha.
Hi, Joe.
So Yaz Rana, our regular host, who looked so fresh-faced and full of life last week after his trip to South Africa, is now consigned to his sick bed. It took just one week back in the UK to undo all that good work. But the show goes on without him, and there is plenty to talk about this week. In South Africa, England sealed a thrilling T20 series victory by chasing down 223 at Centurion, the fourth highest successful chase in the format's history. We've got the Women's T20 World Cup starting any minute now, with hosts Australia and India opening the tournament on Friday. England will be hoping to bounce back quickly from a 10-wicket thrashing by Sri Lanka in their final warm-up match. England Lions have been in action in Australia. Dom Sibley, Keaton Jennings and Dan Lawrence all hitting centuries against the Cricket Australia 11 in Hobart. New Zealand are set to take on India in the first test at Wellington. And just in case you thought there wasn't enough cricket around, news emerged this week that the ICC have proposed two new global tournaments, effectively meaning a white ball world tournament every year and forevermore. Then, in the second part of the show, we're going to go slightly off the beaten track and discuss the England players we really wanted to succeed in international cricket, but who never quite made it for one reason or another.
That's quite a long list on my side.
I'm aware of this, Phil. We're going to leave as much time for that as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've had some good suggestions from followers on Twitter. First, though, let's start with that run fest of a series in South Africa. Phil, I believe your moment of the week came from that one.
Yeah, it has to really, and the way that Owen Morgan finished it off with fire in his eyes, 57 from 22, 57 not out from 22. It's his fifth not out as well in his last 19 games. I've actually done a little bit of stats research, because the impression has been that he's been batting better than ever in T20 cricket, and the numbers are bearing that out. He's broken back into the top 10 in the T20 rankings, leapfrogged Virat as well. And at 33 and a bit, Owen Morgan has an eye on the double and is clearly putting a lot of his energies into that tournament coming up later this year. And he's batting probably with more imperious control than he's ever elicited before. It reminded me in particular that he... What a player he is. Often when somebody becomes a captain, their talents with the bat get subsumed into the story of what they are as a leader and all of that. And this obsession that we have with leaders in cricket is such that sometimes we lose sight of just how good a player they are. And Morgan was the arch finisher in the early part of the last decade when he emerged into that team as this sort of alien figure from nowhere, playing in a different way. And now he's got that World Cup done, his legacy assured, he's now almost freed up to demonstrate what a fine, brilliant player he is. He's striking at 161 per 100 balls over the last 19 games, over the last 2 years. And he is now in that position where he is seeing games off.
We talked about last week, he was furious after blowing it, is a bit harsh, but letting it slip in that first match. And there seemed no chance that he was going to do the same thing on in Centurion.
Yeah, and it would have been terrifying for other teams watching it as well. Not just what Morgan did to see it off, but what happened up top as well with Butler smashing a 50-odd. Who else smashed 50?
Bairstow.
Brain fade, of course. Bairstow, yeah, was excellent at three. I think they were chasing 224 and did it with basically an over to spare.
And they even kind of slowed a little bit in those middle overs when Milan came in. It did make you think, what could they have actually chased there?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's class of Morgan, 0-4, 7-6s,
Yeah, it was a postage stamp ground, and there was a lot of wind blowing around as well. But yeah, when he hits it as clean as that, and it was the processes were so obvious as well. You know, he was moving outside off stump to the full Yorker, opening up his shoulders and just chipping it in effect over square leg. It was Morgan at his best, and we keep seeing it now, time after time. Any suggestion after the World Cup that he may just have shaken hands on the whole show? Well, he's clearly not really built like that. And his game is in the kind of order that you that you would have hoped it would be at this point, 33 years old in his career. He's got one more big blowout to come, and maybe even more than that.
And on that point, I think it's funny how we've talked about Morgan for the last few years, because from that whole World Cup cycle, the 50-0 World Cup cycle, we just talk about Morgan, the leader, and he's kind of, there were often question marks, if he was just a batsman, would he get in that side? Yeah. I mean, of course he does, really. But just because of the way, you know, you had Butler and Stokes and Roy and Bairstow, Morgan sort of kind of got forgotten, and he was just seen as that guy at the front as the leader, basically. That's his only role. But it's, especially in this T20 side, the way he was batting with Stokes at the end of that third match, where, you know, we now see Stokes as the main guy, but Stokes was obviously taking his time to get in, and it was Morgan who just took away all the pressure. And, you know, I think now we're coming to realise again what's been true for the last 10 something years, that Morgan is still...
He's top rank.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thoughts on Butler, Joe, because obviously we spoke about this last week. We don't want to go into it too much.
But I refuse to go down the rabbit hole of England's batting order in T20 cricket. Sure. We're not doing that one.
Sure.
But Butler, yeah.
But what it showed is that, what we said, that the versatility is there, and if you're watching from afar, be afraid, I think. Be very afraid.
I didn't think he even batted particularly well in getting, 57 off 29 balls. He wasn't at his best. He wasn't anywhere near his best in terms of middling the ball. He actually struggled a little bit to start with. But he kind of got through that difficult patch and then was playing really well at the end. They've got so many options. I think the batting is just a case of how you place them. The bowling, though, there are a few more headaches. I mean, they conceded 200 in the second and third T20s, but given the pitches, would anyone have done any better?
I guess is
the question. So in terms of, you look through those, they picked the same bowling attack in all three games, which is interesting in itself, shows that they really want some continuity. They're not just going to try different players. Chris Jordan took 4 wickets, went almost 10 and over, bowling at the death predominantly. Mark Wood, 4 wickets, almost 12 and over. I wanted to get back to it on his skills and whether he has the skills for T20 in the way that some other bowlers do. And then Tom Curran, 5 wickets at 11 and over.
When I thought he bowled well.
Bowling really only exclusive in the power play and at the death, I thought he bowled really well. But on Mark Wood, they obviously want that pace. But when Archer comes back into the side, which he surely will, does Mark Wood have the skills of a modern T20 bowler to be able to nail down a position in this side? He doesn't seem to, he doesn't have the back of the hand slower ball. His wide Yorker doesn't seem to come off if he is trying it. He seemed quite erratic in that final game.
I think he could have been taken out of the attack in the first game as well. Because he just...
Two
beamers, basically.
Got away with that.
Exactly. And I think he got Quinton de Kock off the full toss in the second match. I think it's a good point, because I think over the last year we've seen Mark Wood's sort of resurgence. And when you see that kind of pace, you can understand why England's sort of desperate to get him in, even if it's a T20 and you're sort of looking for different types of skills. The main issue for England, I feel, is just, and what Archer can offer them, is his skills in the power play. Mm. I think over the course of the three matches, the only bowler to take a wicket in the power play for England was Moeen Ali. Got one wicket.
Really?
Yeah.
And South Africa absolutely motored in the power play.
Exactly.
Match, didn't they?
I mean, de Kock was another level.
Bavuma
batted really well as well, but That's where Archer has to come in, because it's those first few overs where, like, Jordan looks brilliant at the death with his Yorker. It's you know, it works, and Tom Curran's working at the death. But when they both bowl at the start, it just sort of seems out of place, really.
And we know Mark Wood doesn't like bowling with a new ball because he finds it too slippery, which I think was part of the reason he bowled those two beamers. So it's he might slip away from that squad, I think. Particularly, we've got Saqib Mahmood, who they'll want to have a proper look at, was in that squad, didn't get a game. They've got to give him a proper opportunity before the start of the World Cup in, well, it's October, isn't it?
Yeah, Saqib's time will definitely come, and probably quite soon. I can absolutely see what you're saying with Wood. I would just add maybe that in Australia, in this tournament, the pitches are quicker, the bounce is there, but also the boundaries are longer as well. And this might sound like a sort of Jack Anori point, but when you're bowling quick in India, when the boundaries are 50 yards, and when you're bowling quick in those T20 games against South Africa, when the boundaries are 50 yards, it's a very, very difficult skill to contain as well as attack. It's very, very hard. You know, half a bat, just a block into the offside and it runs away for 4. You saw it, Bairstow hit a couple of 4s off Steyn, where he's literally just lent on it and it's fizzed away. It's a thankless task, but the task is balanced slightly or mitigated slightly, I think, by the conditions that they would find in Australia. If Wood is going to play in this T20 side, then I think he would play in those conditions more favourably than in any other conditions. That said, I think Saqib, who is, you know, 7 or 8 years younger than Wood, made his name in white ball cricket. He is undoubtedly the coming man. Probably he has a bag of tricks which is slightly more fulsome than Wood's, and maybe that replacement can take place in due course. I think it's probably likely. Tom Curran, his skills are outstanding. Again, he lacks that incisiveness maybe with the new ball in those first few overs, which, as you say, Taha, you know, Archer comes into the equation there. But at the death, he is outstanding for an English bowler.
He's got the temperament for it as well, hasn't he? Almost as much as the skills. He just loves that opportunity. Which...
Yeah, and he gave an interview to Vish a few years ago when he said to Vish, in effect, I realise that, you know, I'm not out and out pace. I realise that I'm not going to be dominating test cricket, but I can be the most skillful one-day bowler in the world. And that's what he said to Vish 2 or 3 years ago. He's not there and may well never get there. But for England's skill level, England's seam bowling skill level, I think he's at the top of the tree for me.
He's also improved with the bat massively. I mean, he got quite a few runs in the Big Bash. He's made himself a really appealing cricketer to pick, hasn't he?
Mm. Just in brackets, the best slower ball bowler of the series was a fella called Dale Steyn, who inexplicably is still playing cricket for South Africa. He's got this new slower ball where he opens up the fingers and rolls them slightly down the right-hand side of the ball, a slight off-cutter. But you're watching it on TV and you're bamboozled yourself.
See the one to Bairstow?
Yeah, and Bairstow ends up kind of leaving it, part playing over the top of it, not really playing a shot. He did one to Stokes as well. Stokes just burst out laughing. So yeah, watch out for him. I think there's something going there.
One to watch.
Yeah.
I think there should be also a mention of David Willey, one of England's best sort of new ball bowlers in T20 eyes, and he's kind of harshly been discarded.
Did you say that because you saw him on the telly at lunchtime at the Oval?
No. I'm saying it because, well, Sam Curran didn't get a look in, so we can't really talk about Sam Curran as the left arm seamer with the new ball. And it kind of feels like Willey's disappeared.
When Freddie Wild,
I thought I should just mention that.
Freddie Wild picked his T20 team of the decade for Wisden.com at the back end of last year and put David Willey in that, didn't he? Which didn't go down especially well in India when I don't think Dhoni was in the side. But
hipster's choice.
Yeah, very much so. All right, well, I think we'll talk about the men's T20 side a lot over the coming months. But more,
and we have done over the last few weeks.
As we have. But more imminently, we've obviously got the Women's T20 World Cup about to start, or depending on when you're listening to this, it may have already started. We've talked quite a bit in the last few weeks about England's chances and can they knock down Australia. I think we'll leave that for now and just see how the matches unfold before kind of covering the same ground. But Taha, you wrote a piece for Wisden.com this week, taking us back to 2009, which was of course the inaugural tournament and also the last time England won it. You spoke to a few of the star names involved in it. What really came across, but it was a very different time for women's cricket, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course. It was just like a 10-day tournament, sort of running alongside the men's thing, but all the group stage matches were in Taunton. They only got to the Oval for the semis, and then the final was, of course, at Lord's. But yeah, just talking about how they prepared for the tournament, where, I mean, England had just won the 50-over World Cup at the start of the year. And with this piece, I talked to Holly Colvin, Charlotte Edwards and Claire Taylor. And, you know, this is the time before full-time contracts. And so one of the first things that Holly Colvin says to me is that she won the World Cup over the winter, came back, and the first thing she did was get a cleaning job at her local sports club, which is just sort of phenomenal to hear. And just now you go 11 years forward and we're in a different, you know, it's a different world completely. It's
Holly
incredible.
Colvin's an interesting one, isn't she? Because she came through very, very young. She did play quite a lot of international cricket, but retired early. And she works for the ICC, doesn't she?
Yeah.
I believe now. Right. And she's kind of missed all the bit that she... I mean, she should be... How old is she now?
I think
she's
only 30.
Yeah, so she could still be in this side. Interesting.
There were a few like that, though, who simply couldn't balance it. They couldn't justify the time that cricket was taking up for no remuneration, really. Isha Guha is another one. You know, she's done okay.
She's done all right for us, haven't she?
Yeah, so don't worry about Ish. But,
and Ebony as well. Ebony Raven.
Yeah, this is it. Ebony had injuries as well, but... there was a narrative back there that there was just no security there, and so girls would look at it at 24, 25, 26 and think, well, I can't really justify this any longer. Whereas now, hopefully, the landscape is changing, and changing again from this summer onwards with more professional domestic contracts in addition to the 20 odd central contracts that the England women already have. So yeah, different landscape entirely in 10 short years. The sooner that the money discrepancies between the men and women is more evenly balanced, the better, I would add.
And to quickly go back to that tournament, oddly, the final wasn't really the pinnacle of the tournament, was it? That was kind of an easy win against New Zealand. It was the semi-final was the game that stuck in people's minds and really was a bit of a, talk about women's cricket without using the word game changer ever, it seems, but in this case, it really was a significant turning point for the view people had of women's cricket, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was one of the great games, England chasing down 164 with, you know, 8 wickets in the bag. But also, you can tell its influence because you did an interview with, I feel like we're just talking about each other's pieces, it's quite nice.
That's fine,
but
it's on the podcast.
You did an interview with Sarah Glenn, and then she picked out that game as well, didn't she? As one that where she kind of could tell people, like, this is women's cricket, this is what it's really about.
Yeah, absolutely. And she said that, and obviously the Women's World Cup final 2017 were the two defining points in deciding that cricket was a career for her. Look, no, we're going to spend the next couple of weeks talking about the Women's T20 World Cup. Should be a really exciting tournament. Australia have shown that they are beatable in the warm-ups. England have shown that they are also beatable by losing to Sri Lanka by 10 wickets, which I know it's a warm-up, but that's a bit of a shocker, isn't it?
It is, but it's also quite good for the tournament, I think. You know, I wrote probably inaccurately that half a dozen teams could lay claim to winning it. It's probably more likely 4. But, you know, in a 10-team tournament, I would say around half at least can feel like they're in with a scrap of getting to the last 4, last 2. This is what the game desperately needs, you know, because the tiers of women's cricket are quite stark, and the more that it can be squeezed up and the playing field in terms of quality can be reasonably levelled out, the better for the game's future. Just in brackets, Thailand women have made it through. It's a stunning story. Taha, you've probably written about this, I would imagine.
No, I haven't. But have you seen the clip with them
New
with
Zealand
the New
team.
Zealand side? After their warm-up.
Yeah, in a kind of Marlon Samuels speaking to like Papua New Guinea players from the qualifier.
It's like quite, you know, quite nice, but also really strange, isn't it? You're just sort of...
I saw a few people saying how patronising it was, but Harry Josephs, one of our team who's out there, said that wasn't at all the case. It was actually much more natural than that, and it didn't come across as patronising if you were there.
Yeah, it was lovely. How people can question the motives of it is slightly odd, yeah. I think. But this is the problem when you film everything. When you film everything and turn everything into content, then straight away people start to question its motives. But anyway, yeah, if Thailand, I don't know, if they can nick a win or even just be there towards the death of a game, what a beautiful story that would be.
So we haven't done your moment of the week yet, have we?
No, so...
Do you have a moment of the week, Taha?
I do, yeah. So it's basically been the MCC's tour of Pakistan.
Yes.
Spoke to Kumar Sangakkara last week.
That was a big moment for you, wasn't it?
Just what I do now, Phil.
Mizpah one week, Kumar the next.
Be honest, were you nervous?
I was really nervous, yeah. But I was really happy with how cool I played it. Yeah. Okay. Joked around with him. It's like, just, oh, thanks, Kumar.
And the content of the interview as well. Is that also good?
That was all right, too.
Did you feel... I used to ghost a column for him in an old magazine that we used to do. In fact, in the current magazine that we used to do, as well as an old magazine. And the crackly line from Sri Lanka when he used to talk to me used to sound like Winston Churchill on an old sort of Pathé News sort of... Did you get that impression when you were talking to him?
He's just so... He's just a statesman, isn't he?
Exactly, you know, exactly.
Yeah. The transcription was a breeze.
Yeah.
The dramatic pauses, certainly as though he is addressing a nation each time he's speaking to you. And which can't help but be slightly humbling.
Indeed. You wrote about it, Taha.
But should we do the background on the tour itself? So MCC have taken a side out there, captained by Sangakkara, who's also the MCC president these days, to play 4 games?
Yeah, so they played 4 games. But the first one was like the big one. So they played at Gaddafi Stadium, which, you know, 11 years ago, that's the stadium the Sri Lanka team were on their way to when that terror attack happened. So Sangakkara returned there for the first time. And so they played in front of 18,000 people, This is just a fixture with one of the PSL sides, Lahore Qalandars. And you know, I was watching it, the MCC streamed it live, so I was watching it, but you know, it wasn't really about the cricket. It was just a bit of a run-of-the-mill T20, but you could just see the cameras panning around to the fans. Shaheen Afridi is just walking around the boundary,
nice,
just taking selfies with everyone, and it was just, you know, it was just great to see. Basically,
it was interesting that the piece you wrote, Ajmal Shahzad, the old former England quick, who's now the MCC head coach, saying when he was putting this squad together for the tour, he's like, oh, God, am I going to be able to get the numbers together? Because we're not offering them much money at all, really. It's just about expenses.
Yeah.
And then when he said he started making phone calls, everyone was up for it.
Yeah. And it was just like, you know, it's better than, you know, we're here at the Oval. It's pretty grim out here. You know, it's better than to just go to Pakistan, you know, nice weather, experience something new. And, you know, like he said, and it's the correct point, that they're going to go down in history. This doesn't happen very often, so it's a big deal.
Yeah, this is encouraging. I mean, basically the tour was to re-emphasise Pakistan's return to the international fold, and so far, so good, really. I mean, we had the tour against Sri Lanka tour to Pakistan recently. Now this, the doors are open and everyone's welcome. And
the people are flooding through the doors. Certainly that last test match when Nazim took the hat-trick.
Yeah. Of course, Bangladesh have been there as well, haven't they?
Yeah, in that game, and... Yeah, there were a lot of folks through the doors. It had that vibe and that atmosphere that you crave, really. Yeah, it's the story of the last few years, really, for me. You know, and hopefully no more hiccups, and it can be normalised. And you know, once you see an England touring team touch down in Lahore, Karachi, that's when you'll really know. And same with Australia as well. India, maybe we'll have to wait.
I mean, while we're on the subject of Pakistani cricket, a significantly less feel-good story came out this morning, which is that Umar Akmal, Pakistan's 29-year-old batsman, has been suspended by the Pakistan Cricket Board with immediate effect for violation of its anti-corruption code. Now, the PCB haven't revealed any further details at this stage, but at a time of real positivity for Pakistani cricket, this is the story that they really didn't need, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of... yeah, even when... there was the sort of goodwill of the last week that they came the news about South Africa not touring because of player workload, as in that will eventually happen, but for now the plan was initially that they were going to come in March, but that was not happening either. So yeah, just especially the PSL starting today, you know, the day we're speaking, and Umar Akmal was going to play in that game for Quetta probably, and now he's out, and it's kind of...
He's had a...
The Umar Akmal story continues.
Yeah, well, he's had an eventful couple of weeks, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, didn't he reveal a little bit more than was strictly necessary?
After failing a fitness test.
Apparently it was a misunderstanding.
Sure. Yeah. Where's the fat? The immortal line, where's the
fat?
Yeah,
he disrobed. Yeah. But anyway, he got away. They warned him about his responsibilities, but didn't punish him for that. But this time, he has been punished. He's unavailable for the foreseeable. It struck me a little bit odd that Pakistan have even returned to Umar Akmal in the first place. He's not got a particularly
spotless record
is a good way of putting it, and his record as a batsman, he's obviously fantastically talented, but his record isn't so good that it demands selection. You spoke to Misbah about this
just
recently.
Another name drop. Yeah, so I was speaking to Misbah for the next issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, and he was talking about picking Umar Akmal for the Sri Lanka T20Is, which was one of his first assignments, and it was basically, he didn't so much to say it was about giving a clean slate, but his arguments were solely cricketing reasons, in that I mean, everyone knows how good a player Umar Akmal is. At the time, Mohammad Hafeez and Shoaib Malik were out of Pakistan's squad, and they, because they just weren't in good enough nick and needed players in form, and Umar Akmal had a pretty good PSL along with Ahmed Shahzad, who's another player who's had a sort of tricky road basically, and so that was those were purely the reasons for picking them, but you know, obviously didn't come off, and now here we are again with Umar Akmal.
Anyway, that is enough of the serious stuff. Now time for some frivolous chat about cricket, which is obviously the stuff we all turn up for.
Needed a jingle, that didn't it?
Did maybe we can add one in. Yeah, as if you're
editing, like on the Adam and Joe show.
This actually came out of me misunderstanding Yaz's handover notes, but we both agreed it's better than what he originally planned anyway. So, Phil, Taha, the question, which we've also put to our followers on Twitter, is which England players over the years have you been desperate to see succeed but for whatever reason, it's just not quite happened. And a few people on Twitter have suggested, people like James Hildreth, Chris Rasworth, what we're looking for here are people who did get a chance with England, but it didn't happen. Obviously, in the case of Hildreth and Rasworth, done amazing things in county cricket, but the chance has never come. So that's the sort of slightly blurry distinction we're going for here. Should I start with something we've got on social media? And then...
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. We've got the mighty G SR7, who's gone with Dawid Malan. Obviously, still has a chance to come back. Toby Rowland-Jones, that's hard to argue with, given the injury he got just before the last Ashes. Graham Onions, who crops up a couple of times here.
Did Onions not have some impact, albeit over a short period of time?
Well, this is what James Chetwood, who actually was my first 11 captain at Sussex Uni, responded saying exactly... Hello, James, if you're listening. said exactly that. He said, well, right. he did succeed, but I think you can still... He only played, what, 9 test matches?
Right, okay.
So I think you could still argue that however well he did in those test matches, he didn't manage to do exactly what he could have done.
Yeah,
really.
Okay.
Other couple from the mighty, Mark Stoneman and James Foster. And just another couple more. Oscar Radcliffe came out of Owis Shah, Plunkett, Sajid Mahmood, Ajmal Shahzad, we mentioned earlier. And David Tossell comes in with Owis Shah, a bit more detail. Genius at the crease, but mismanaged horribly. 88 in India on debut and plays one more test in 3 years, wasting the peak years of his first-class career. Shah was an odd one, wasn't he? England under-19 captain, known as the most talented batsman of his age in England. And it just never really fell into place, certainly in test cricket.
Yeah, he had a run over a brief period of time in the ODI side. And
quite successfully for
a bit. Yeah, this is it. And pulled out one or two trees. Made a brilliant 96. No, in fact, brilliant 100 here at the Oval.
Same game that Mascarenhas hit 5-6
the one
in a row, yeah.
Against India. Yeah, Tossell's bang on. He's also a very good judge of the game full stop, David Tossell. But yeah, he's absolutely right. I remember that because I watched that innings live. Did you see it as well, Joe, at the time? It was 06, wasn't it? Or was it no? No, late.
What in India?
Yeah.
No, I didn't see that at the time.
He got cramp. Do you remember this? So he got cramp. He was 30-odd not out. And I remember the commentators really going quite hard at him, as if to say, "You can't get to this level and find that you know your body's not quite right, and you haven't sufficiently looked after yourself in the moment to ensure that you don't have to go off retired hurt with cramp." It just felt like a slightly kind of village juvenile way to go through that first innings. And I thought we got a lot of unfair criticism on the back of that. But clearly the subtext was Owais was not particularly trusted by the top brass as a man to hang your hat on.
He was known as a bit of a loose cannon, wasn't he? He had the Middlesex captaincy for less than a season, I think, possibly.
Yeah. And it was peculiarly explained euphemistically that, you know, he basically wasn't mature enough to take on the job.
I thought with the cramp, didn't he later say that he was tense and gripping the bat handle so hard that he gave himself cramp?
Yeah. And I remember the grip of the bat had ridden up, so there was kind of only half a grip left on his back because he was just gripping it so hard. But yeah, a player of talent, no doubt. He played the first test match after that winter in England, and he unluckily nicked off. I think he nicked off kind of off his shoulder of the bat or something like that. After everyone else had got runs, I think it was against West Indies, and he got none. And I think that was his last ever test match. And yeah, he slips into quite a vast group of flighty, attractive, doomed, fragile middle order batsmen.
There are quite a few that have come through.
Give us a couple more.
Well, another one who's come up a few times here is Mark Lathwell, the Somerset opener.
Yeah.
No, I mean he was known as the kind of a prodigious talent who. No.
Well, he was, but on the flimsiest of evidence, he made 130. And I remember this quite clearly. He made 130 out of about 200 in an early season game of that 93 season. Now, all right, that's a great innings at any level. And obviously he was opening at the time and he went out there and he smashed it. And it was an unusual innings because no one else got any runs that day. But that was essentially it. That was the lightning rod moment. And when England were 2-0 down, having played 8 days of cricket and already losing the Ashes, he was brought in to open with Gooch. Now there is a yin and yang pairing right there. And he was patently not really ready for it at all. And his career
And damaged for it, wasn't it? I mean, he left the game very early, just saying he didn't really enjoy it anymore, I think.
Indeed, yeah. I think he became a postman, actually. That might be wrong.
That's one
from the recesses.
We'll check that.
Yeah, but he was kind of harshly thrown into that sort of great white hope role with next to no real evidence behind it. A lot of players hadn't even really seen him as well, and he was not, from what I remember people saying over the years, he wasn't really cut out for the cut and thrust of Test cricket. There was a rumour that he actually licked his plate clean in the Lord's dining room in one of his
first games. Seen you do that before, Phil.
Yeah, exactly, but I don't open for England. Not yet, anyway. I'm in my own list.
God. All right, we'll start.
He's not in my list, Joe.
All right.
Lathwell.
I was going to... Taha, anyone you want to throw into the mix here?
I'm going to go quite kind of deep here.
We need some music for this as well.
So I'm coming at this slightly differently. So as a Pakistani-born Brit, growing up, I was always sort of desperate for players that looked like me to do well for England.
Yeah.
So, you know, Owe Shah, not for the reasons that have been mentioned, but just because I had this similar sort of background, that kind of thing appealed to me. So it was, you know, Owe Shah, Ajmal Shahzad, Bapara, Sam Patel.
Bapara comes up quite a lot here, actually, as well.
And even to an extent, Monty, because you kind of hope that after Swan retired that, you know, Monty would go on and finally become England's number one spinner again, and that kind of vibe. So those were the guys that I really wanted to succeed. And it's only in the last couple of years now that we have Mo and, you know, Adil Rashid, who have really become, they're not just bit part players, they're the main guys in the team, and so that's meant a lot, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention Panesar, who would have taken 120 odd Test wickets, something like that. I'll ramble and then look it up as we go, because I initially put Tufnell in my list because I remember his opening salvos as an international player, and he had a similarly powerful impact as did Panesar.
167 Test wickets for Panesar.
Really? Oh, I've done him. I've
50
done him
tests. There. I mean, I'm not sure he qualifies for this list, really. I can see he perhaps didn't fulfil his talent.
But yeah, it's pushed to include
him. He's no Darren Maddy.
I took Tufnell out of my list in the end because I just thought, and he had taken 100 plus.
He had his moments in the sun, didn't he? And I think most people here are going for players that didn't even really get to that stage. I mean, there are a few. So Neil McGrath has picked out James Vince, another who could come back. Hasib Hamid, a bit early to perhaps be writing him off. Tom Wesley.
Mm-hmm.
James Kirtley, obviously had a few decent moments but struggled with his action. Got called a couple of times.
Mm.
Adam Lythe, who came through, had that brilliant 100 at Headingley and then disappeared after an Ashes series to forget. And then Alex Tudor, I think.
Ah, yeah.
It was a good one. I mean, he obviously did have his couple of moments. Scored that 99 not out at Edgbaston.
Yeah. Yeah,
when Graham Thorpe denied him his, I think Alex Tudor said his family still hate Graham Thorpe for denying him his.
He told me a story that Thorpe pulled up at some lights in London somewhere, and this car pulled up next to him, and everyone wound their window down and just started hurling abuse at him the week after. Tudor would definitely have made my list if I'd remembered him. Absolutely, you know, tall, fast, lovable. Did the business in Australia, briefly suggested that he would have some kind of future, but injuries absolutely kiboshed him. You know, great man and a big loss, because he was unusual, I think, for that time.
Was he? Do you think he was mismanaged or just unlucky?
It's hard to say. Yeah. It's hard to know, really. He would probably say no.
He's certainly not someone who's bitter about the game, is he, in the way that some other names that we might have mentioned in this list.
In a similar vein, David Lawrence, Sid Lawrence.
He came up, actually.
Did he?
Yep, Mark TRFL. David Lawrence and Greg Thomas together, obviously two quicks who never quite made it. Greg Thomas was known as the fastest white bowler in the world for
Zimbabwean.
A time.
I think it was Zimbabwean, not just South African. Yeah, yeah, he played for Glamorgan for a few years. I think he played in 89 in that Ashes series. I think he played a game or two under Gower in that series. But Sid Lawrence was a travesty, really. He played at the Oval in 91 against West Indies. I think it was his second game, got Viv out, albeit caught at longish mid on. And then went on that tour that winter to New Zealand, 91-2, and snapped his knee horrifically and was never the same again.
I mean, that injury, there's still footage. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend watching it, but I don't think I've ever seen such a bad sports, a cricket injury, like on the field at that moment. I mean, you can actually hear the break, couldn't you?
Indeed, because it was an empty ground, the fag end of a dead test match. And yet this lad was tearing in, giving it his all, and he slipped in his delivery stride and the knee shot out. Oh, and God. It was like a pistol crack around an empty, echoing ground. And yeah, one of the worst, really. Obviously, Simon Jones falls into that category as well. But then when you ask about legacy, you know, have you had those moments in the sun? Well, Jones said, maybe through slightly gritted teeth, famously, I'd rather have played in that Ashes series than have played 80 test matches.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's entirely true, but you never know. I get where he's coming from.
The name that jumped out for me was another quick bowler who suffered injury, which is Dean Headley. I grew up just a few minutes from the St. Lawrence ground in Canterbury, watched him a lot, Sunday league games, tearing in off this long run-up, took loads of wickets. I think the one year he took three hat-tricks in a first-class season, which I think is still a record. He was loved at Kent. Brilliant every season, then got his England chance. Because I think he was on the books at Middlesex, didn't quite work out for him. So it all happened a bit later than you might have expected. And then he kind of ate Aussie left-handers for breakfast, didn't he, one summer, and then took six for Melbourne.
To win that test match.
To win that famous test match. And then just back problems meant I've got his record here, 15 tests, 60 wickets at 28. And again, retired relatively early. But was a bowler who I think he really could have been a really successful England fast bowler at that time.
Yeah, he was a precursor to Hoggard. You know, ran in all day and had that late swinging away swinger and just hit that corridor.
A little bit quicker than Hoggard's?
But this is what I was coming to. I think he could have been a better bowler than Hoggard overall if he'd stayed fit, because he was a bit bigger, a bit stronger, took wickets in Australia, obviously, as you mentioned, in a way that Hoggy couldn't manage. But stylistically quite similar bowlers, I thought. And yeah, it's a very good one, Headley. I personally didn't ever have that personal connection with him, but those figures tell a story. You know, that's one that really got away.
Again, another bowler who kind of, you could argue he had his day in the sun, definitely. Tremlett, I think, could have been, you know, he could have been one of the great England fast bowlers, really, just how good he was in that series down under, and then the summer that followed for the first half. And then after that, there was just one injury, and then it kind of, the way he faded, and then when they brought him back for that Ashes, it was quite sad, because he just wasn't that bowler again. And he had all the attributes to be one of the...
Although even that Ashes series, I think people kind of thought by then his chance had gone. I mean, how old was he in the 10-11 Ashes?
I can't remember.
Because he'd emerged as a very young bowler, had his opportunities, got injured, faded away. So I think he almost had this kind of, Indian summer, if you like, that people didn't necessarily see coming. And then, but you're absolutely right, then it disappeared again very, very quickly after that. But he certainly had kind of, a bit like Steve Harmison, there's just everything there that a fast bowler could possibly want. But those injury problems. He's now the biggest man in the world, I think. Have you seen pictures of him?
You imagine him trying to bowl now? He wouldn't be able to get his arm past
no
the
chance.
Perpendicular. He looks ridiculous.
No chance. Michael Cooper, who I think might be, he did work experience with us a little while. It's the same Michael Cooper. And Rob McGregor went for Chris Reid.
Right.
Certainly the kind of loved by county fans, not so much by Duncan Fletcher.
Yeah,
it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Up there with James Foster as the best keeper of his generation. But
I always thought his bat looked too big for him when he played for England.
Everything looked a bit too big, like his pads looked really big for him as well.
So my list is long, and I'm not going to read it through because you haven't allowed me to. But try as I might to summon some emotion for a wicketkeeper, I couldn't. So there is no keeper
just,
in
what,
my
you just don't see them as human? Or
I wouldn't say they're subhuman, Joe, in my head.
I'm just wondering why their role means that you can't have any kind of sympathy for them.
I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I would be lying if I said that
Even James Foster, your mate Fozzie.
Yeah, but I knew him. I know him from when we were kids. Did I desperately want Jimmy Foster to get back in the team? After he'd had an Ashes series, I thought, all right, mate, you know, that's probably enough. You don't need to be too successful, thank you very much. The old Morrissey line, you know, you hate when your friends become successful.
Well, it gives you a few more stories though, doesn't it?
So. True. No, I'd be lying, you know, if I said I was ever that passionate about Chris Reid's chances in the England side, or you know, whether Geraint Jones could catch a few more or make a few more relevant runs down the pipe. I just don't have that connection with wicketkeepers. So it's why the whole Ben Folkes conversation, you know, it swells around, but I can't quite get my way into it. But this is a failing in me, obviously. It's what things I don't understand, I just instinctively just dismiss.
So wicketkeeping off. All right, so who can you have some sort of sympathy for? Flighty batsman.
Wayne Larkins, Michael Carberry, Tom Wesley, John Crawley in capital letters.
He got mentioned by, let me pick out a name here, Dom Ashton. Picked out John Crawley along with Matthew Maynard again.
Right. Me and Dom. Dom or John?
Dom.
Dom, yeah, me and Dom on the same page on that one. James Vince, Ravi, obviously. Oase was in my list. Chris Lewis, 32 tests and 53 ODIs for a player of that kind of talent. Adil Rashid in my test head is in there.
Yeah.
He's a player that I was desperate to do well at test level. I still don't think that we fully know either. It was interesting, Bumble sent a tweet in the midst of the series just gone, saying Adil Rashid is the bowler that we need in Sri Lanka in that test series and in India as well.
I'm not sure he agrees, though. He's just signed a white ball contract with Yorkshire, hasn't he?
Indeed. Peter Such, my first batting coach. Now, this falls
Peter
into
Such
the category.
Your batting coach?
My first batting coach got me in the Essex team as an 11-year-old and famously perhaps the worst batsman to ever... Chris Martin accepted to play test cricket. Draw your own conclusions, I suppose. But he played 11 tests, did Screaming Pete Such, and arguably there were 11 more tests than many people thought he was going to play. Certainly I thought that when he was playing for Essex 2s and coaching me, but I was so thrilled to see him make that debut against Australia, Old Trafford, 1993, and he took 6 for on day one. Glorious scenes, beautiful scenes, and it never got any better than that. So he's in my list because I was so desperate for him to play a little bit more. And then a few more: Ali Brown, obviously, Stephen Davis,
Brown's a good one.
Obviously, Ed Joyce as well. I always had a soft spot for Ed Joyce. I think Ed Joyce could have made something of Test cricket.
His record
and ODI cricket
for Sussex over many seasons was extraordinary.
He made 100 at Brisbane in an ODI against Australia, and that was pretty much his only moment in an England kit.
And it was an odd one because I've always thought of him as a much better long format player than a ODI player, but it was ODIs that he got his chance. I mean, it was around the 2005 Ashes that it had been at its peak, but there was actually quite a lot of English batsmen scoring a lot of runs at that point.
Yeah, one of those that the time just didn't quite work out for him.
Yeah.
Just going back briefly to Crawley and then I'll shut up. I saw his debut at Lord's in 94 against South Africa, and he came into that summer as the hot young thing in English cricket. He'd made a brilliant 100 the year before for England A team, as it was then, against Warn. And Warn said he was the best player of spin that he bowled to that summer. And he'd broken all records for Lancashire and schools cricket as well. And he came into that side and he made 2 single figure scores in that first test match against Donald. Although I remember the 2 scoring shots he got off the mark to, the first 2 fours he hit, both stunning through mid-wicket. You know, braced front leg, all wrists. And he was godlike through mid-wicket, but he was found out a little bit with that ball outside off stump. But he is a player whose record shows, I think, that if he'd been trusted a little bit more, if he'd played in a different era, he had the components to be a really good player. His record against spin is excellent.
Well, he got 100 here against Murali in that test, didn't he? Was it 100?
Got an unbeaten 156 here against Murali in 98.
Yeah.
His record in Australia from a smallish sample size is not bad. He made a couple of good 50s in that 94-5 tour when Warn was unstoppable. He played in 97 against Australia. Remember that series when England won that first test and then it all fell away after that. And he would have been about 27, 28, I guess, around that time. So theoretically in his prime. But he came up against that team. And I looked it up because I had this memory. His first innings results were poor. 1 single figure scores across 4 test matches. But his second innings results were very good, including an 83 against Warn at Old Trafford when it was turning big in the 4th innings. And there were moments through his record that suggested that he had the game to have been far more successful international player. But he was quite sensitive bloke, wasn't the fittest of fellas. He had issues around his fitness. He liked a fag. That was another reason why, you know, I was always in his camp. And an interesting character, yeah, Cambridge grad and good bloke. I've interviewed him a couple of times since it all stopped. And an interesting fella, but one that really got away, I think, for England.
So I was speaking to David English the other day, who runs the Bunbury Festival. So it's the best players of under 15 age group across the country every year since 1986. I think they've been doing this. Asked him, who's the most talented player you've seen across all that time? And he said John Crawley straight away.
Really?
It was the first name he mentioned, yeah.
He had real style as well. Yeah, yeah, real stylist of a player. Anyway, obviously I could go on all day, but I think...
Well, I had another one. It's a bit... I wouldn't actually say he is one of my favourite players, but just in terms of the career he had and the lack of opportunity for England, Glenn Chappell's got to be around there as well. He took 985 first-class wickets, played one ODI for England, bowled 24 balls and then went off injured and was constantly the next seamer in. I think he was in a couple of test squads, never got his chance. I mean, I know people in Lancashire think this is a kind of vastly unfair, and I think they're probably right on that, really. I mean, his record is extraordinary. You think it of at least... It's amazing if you think some of the England seamers that have got games over the years, yet Chappell never played a test match.
And also, he was a bit nippier and quicker.
In his youth, he wasn't... Yeah, I mean, obviously later on, he became more of your sort of Darren Stevens sort of speed, but early on he was fast medium just.
Bicknell's another one, although he was probably 3 or 4 mile an hour too slow for that level. But again, if you look at his first class record versus the number of test match chances that he received, he took over 1,000 wickets for Surrey and yet played I think 4 test matches, top of my head, something like that. Plenty of stories similar to those really.
Steve Finn,
yeah.
Kind of strange seeing him this winter doing, you know, punditry.
Very
really.
Well. He's an excellent
Very
pundit.
Well, but...
Yeah, he should still be bowling fast for England, really.
Yeah.
And then you go through the list of the all-time great strike rates in Test cricket, and, if you know, run down that list on that first page, and there is Finn's name.
And I mean, he didn't get a 100 contract this summer. I mean, and he was, for a while, he was England's best one-day bowler, I thought. As well, he had a really good series out in India a few years ago.
2013, that kind of period, I think.
Yeah. And it's all kind of obviously disappeared quite quickly. It's not like he takes a stack of wickets in county cricket either.
Ali Brown, it's still the biggest shocker, selectorial shocker of my time following England, I think. That he was consistently overlooked despite being far and away the most destructive one-day batsman in the country. Baffling, utterly baffling. He made two double hundreds in domestic cricket. 264 he made in one innings. No, 268, sorry, I've done him out of 4.
And it wasn't that he was just a county slogger, was it? I mean, he whacked it.
He averaged 40-odd in first-class cricket.
Yeah,
he averaged 40-odd in first-class cricket. He played, I think, 13 games for England, something like that. I'm throwing some numbers out here without really...
Wildly.
But it was something like that. It was in the low teens,
I think.
He got 100. Made 100, exactly.
He got 100, didn't he?
Made 100 against India, and he made a really good 38, I think it was, on his debut in tricky conditions against South Africa, which I've spoken to him about, and he says, I couldn't have played much better. And he showed that he had a technique as well as a hitting game, and yet they just overlooked him.
Another couple that we mentioned, Lokesh Patel, Mark Ramprakash. I mean, it's hard to say no to that one. I think if we're picking 11, he's got to be in there. And Brian Henderson, boss of Sky Cricket, says his colleague Rob Key, which I'd agree with that one.
Yeah, Keezy.
Enough promising moments to think there was a real Test career in there, and it never quite happened. I think maybe he was known as a bit of a boozer, liked a fag as well. I'm not sure that necessarily helped him at that time with Duncan Fletcher. But also, again, there were a lot of batsmen scoring a lot of runs in county cricket at the time in a way that they just aren't now for various reasons.
Yeah, you're probably right, actually. The timing of it wouldn't have worked out for Key.
He was very much in the minds of selectors for 2009 when Trott got the call. It was kind of Trott, Ramprakash or Key that were being discussed at that time, and Trott was obviously the only one that hadn't played Test cricket and got the nod.
Yeah, just thinking about those early years. So he played in South Africa before the Ashes, didn't he? He played in that early 05 series and... and made a decent 80-odd in the second innings, or the first innings at Joburg, but not much else either side of that. And then that summer came round and it wasn't his go. But the previous summer against West Indies, made the double, obviously, at Lord's. But he made an unbeaten 90 the following test match at Old Trafford. And it looked then, albeit it was against a team down on its luck in the West Indies, it looked then like England may have found one, found the number three to do the job. A year on, and you know, that kind of seismic moment of the 05 Ashes, and he wasn't in the mix. But yeah, I can see that. I can certainly see that. I think that's a fair shout.
Well, I think have I said everyone? Foxy Phil, is that your alter ego on Twitter, Phil? No, he said Darren. He said Darren Maddy, so it's unlikely to have been you, I'd have thought. And our own Jim Wallace, Simon Smudge Brown, Durham left armour, one test match, I think.
Yeah.
He is the only person to have said Simon Brown in this list.
That's why he's written it, because he was banking on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, a mustachioed left arm beanpole. What's so funny?
Just a nice sequence of words. Taha, any late suggestions before we call this done?
No, you're just mentioning names that, you know, played before I was born, so I'm kind of struggling.
You're kind of out of your comfort zone here, aren't you? But anyway, we did your stuff earlier on, so that's fine.
And if you want 20 minutes on Wayne Larkins, or should we call this one?
I think we'll do that as a special rather than tag it onto this one.
Okie dokie.
So I reckon it would be nice if we did come up with an 11, but obviously we can't. Let's not do it now. But I think we go away. Keep your suggestions coming in. Over the course of the next week, we'll come up with an 11 and reveal it on next week's show. How about that?
All right, done.
Sounds good.
All right. So next week, we'll be discussing the first week of the Women's T20 World Cup and looking back on the first test between New Zealand and India in Wellington. Thanks as ever for listening. Remember to subscribe through the usual podcast apps if you've not already. And if you've liked what you've heard, don't be afraid to leave us a 5-star review.